here beside me is Dr. Nick Martorano.
Hello.
He is an Italian who had his training in the States and now practicing in the Philippines.
That's right.
Quite a Nick, combination. What happened to the bird?
Well, I had to trim my beard and shave it off because I think it was more culturally appropriate to not have a beard, because oftentimes it seems to be associated with negative things here in the Philippines. So, as they say, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, and so I did. That way I will not manage to scare away the children.
That's very good.
And their parents.
Okay, I was saying a while ago you had your training in the States. Where was that?
Yes, it was for quite a few years at the University of California.
Okay.
And then also the medical school of Harvard Medical School.
Yeah. You have your Doctor of Philosophy in...
It's in Developmental Psychology from the University of California. And I have a whole bunch of other, you know, specialties from JFK University.
Yeah, and JFK, I've read
that was play therapy.
That's right.
Play therapy, which is one of the, you know, main ways of working with children in a therapeutic setting. And then a specialty from the Harvard Medical School in infant-parent relationship, which is also a key component when you're working with young kitten children, because even though the child may have a problem, this could be psychological or developmental, you have to work also with the parents, because the parents are always, you know, in the picture. They see and are with the child 24 hours a day.
Okay.
So you typically work with a lot of, not just the child, but a lot more people around the child.
Okay, so first time I featured you here was sometime in January.
Correct.
Start of the year, and I know you've been practicing now.
Right.
For quite 3 or 4 months already.
Correct.
So from your patients, what are the common child problems that you've encountered here so far?
There's been a few patients that I've seen that would show, for example, autistic children. I've seen a few of them.
Autism.
There seems to be quite a few cases of autism in young children here in Bacolod. It's still not clear why, but there's definitely a need out there. Mm-hmm. And my role when I see autistic children, depending on the case, of course, but usually has to do with helping the parents, for example, cope with the behaviors that the autistic child may exhibit at home or in school. For example, being very active or being very irritable. Having a hard time to kind of communicate their needs and wants. So at the same time that the child may be seen by a speech therapist to address issues like language and by what's called an occupational therapist for decreasing their high sensitivity to things.
Okay, so let's go back to the speech therapist. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's really the role of a speech therapist in?
Well, I sometimes refer some of my patients out to a speech therapist when I see that there is, for example, a delay in speech. That is, expressive skills. Like, the classic case would be a 5-year-old who speaks more like a 2.5-year-old or a 3-year-old. So instead of having, you know, hundreds and hundreds of words, this kid may only have just, you know, a handful of words. And so the role of the speech therapist, among the many, of course, is to boost the number of words and also, for example, the pronunciation of these words to help the child communicate their wants and needs. Because if the child cannot communicate what they want and what they need, they have to use a different way of doing it, right?
Yeah.
And typically it's going to be some behavioral way.
That's right.
You know, acting out, being aggressive, things that we're trying to bring down by bringing up language.
Yeah, that's right.
So as one goes up, the other typically goes down. Mm-hmm.
What about the role of, you were mentioning a while ago, of an occupational therapist?
Okay. Oftentimes children with autism, but not only, other children too, have what is called sensory integration difficulties.
What's that?
It's a fancy word for basically saying that they have a nervous system that is quite sensitive. This could be sensitive to, for example, touch.
Okay.
So these may be children that react very strongly to just like a gentle pat, a gentle kind of stroke.
Right.
Or, for example, children that have a nervous system that is so sensitive that just like a regular conversation like the one that we're having right now, for them it's just way too loud.
Too loud.
So they'll be like, ah. Okay. Or they may be very sensitive to the physical proximity.
Okay.
So this distance for them would be already too much. Mm-hmm. So they pull away.
They tend to, yeah.
Right.
Put some distance.
Excuse me?
Put some distance.
That's right. Yeah. Put some distance. So the role of an occupational therapist, of course, they have a lot of different roles. But in this case, would be, for example, to bring down that sensitivity by, for example, if you're looking at touch, touch sensitivity, there is a technique called the brushing technique.
Brushing technique.
Where on a daily basis, a few times a day, first the occupational therapist and then the parent, once the parent knows and learns about that, they brush with a certain kind of special brush the entire body of the child to desensitize their nerves and their nervous system.
To increase the threshold.
Correct. So that regular stimuli coming from the environment, this could be a touch or like that proximity with the person, will not trigger the strong reaction. And typically I see wonderful results already within 3 to 6 months if it's done daily on a consistent basis. Because again, when you're working with the nervous system, you have to work on a daily basis. It's like playing the piano, right?
Yeah, that's right.
You're not going to be the Chopin of the situation or Beethoven if you just play, you know, and practice once a month. You really have to play every day because your fingers and therefore your brain needs to learn
coordination.
And so it's the same thing with, you know, sensory integration difficulties. To bring down that threshold, the sensitivity, we have to work on a daily basis, particularly with autistic children.
Uh-huh. And how are their results so far with this kind of?
Well, I've seen some improvement. Mm-hmm. Again, things do take time, so it'll be interesting to see in 6 months what really happens. Based on my past experience with a lot of these kids back in the States, I would not hesitate to expect some good results. Let's say it comes probably September or October. It takes time to, you know, learn a technique, to practice it every day.
And so it's the management for these children is not only you, but it takes multidisciplinary approach.
That's right. Correct. That's very crucial because of the complexity of what they have, these children need to be handled, so to say, by a lot of specialists and the family.
And I think the big role that you have here is, when I say multidisciplinary, different specialists plus the parents.
Correct.
And it's your role to teach the parents also how to to react to this, how to deal with this.
Right. And also how to be empowered.
Yeah.
Because oftentimes, based on my experience, even in the States, you may have a meeting at the school where, you know, people are gathering to understand, you know, what's going on with the child and to have some suggestions about, you know, things that they can do. And oftentimes the parent kind of gets forgotten, you know, all this.
Yeah,
so my role oftentimes is to really be a spokesperson, so to say, for the parent and make sure that the parent's needs are met. Mm-hmm. So that they don't get lost in the system, so to say.
That's right. Because they really play an active role.
Oh, it's huge. The role that a parent plays is huge. The parent can always pull the plug on the kid anytime.
Uh-huh.
Right? Whether it's me or a speech therapist, occupational therapist, or even the school, if they're not happy. So we want to make sure the parents feel empowered and happy with the services so that then their child can benefit from, you know, let's say 6 months of therapy, whether it's me or a speech therapist or other people.
Yeah, and I'm sure a lot of problems or behavioral problems with children can be traced back to parents.
It's not uncommon. It's not uncommon. It kind of, you know, takes two to tango. It's typically an interaction. What I mean by that is that you may have the same family situation with problems. For example, the classic would be, you know, marital discord. So a lot of, you know, quarrels and disagreements and verbal fights among the two parents. But different children may react differently.
Okay.
So even though you may have the same kind of, you know, tense situation in the family, just that will not be the sole cause of behavioral problems. You may have a child who is kind of, you know, quiet and flexible and whose temperament is such that he's kind of like an easy kid. And he or she may kind of overall make the most of what's going on. But if you put a child with what's called a difficult temperament, you know, kind of feisty, very sensitive, in the same family situation with a lot of disagreements and quarrels, that's when that may be quite a combination, and that could lead to, you know, behavioral problems in the kid because they're kind of feeding each other.
I remember a story that there are two brothers. They have a drunkard father,
mm-hmm.
drinks too much.
Yep.
When they grow up, one became a drunkard also.
Mm-hmm.
The other became a teetotaler.
Mm. Yes.
Really no alcohol.
Right.
And when they were asked, what's the reason why you became a drunkard?
Mm-hmm.
This brother answered, what can you expect of my father?
Right. Right.
The other guy, when he was also asked, why did you become a teetotaler?
Right.
You really shun alcohol. What can you expect of my father? They have the same
that's
answer.
Right, that's right.
Two different reactions.
Yes, and it turns out the research shows very clearly that typically you have in this kind of situations, you know, whether you're dealing with alcohol, abuse, or drugs, there's typically three different kinds of children.
Okay.
Basically, three different reactions to that. One, the one that you mentioned is, well, you know, just do what, you know, your father or mother was doing. So if it's drinking, you're going to be drinking. If it's doing drugs, you're going to be doing drugs. The second one is the opposite. So you're kind of reacting and going towards the opposite extreme,
yeah.
you know, totally being, you know, away from that. Oftentimes, these kids will then develop in very controlling persons,
mm-hmm.
because control is the only way that you can, you know, put those fears at bay.
Yeah, okay.
And then there's the person that will, the child, and then there are four when they grow up. The person that will try to kind of have a behavior such that they'll try all the time not to cause any problem. So they'll be the very quiet, meek
mm-hmm.
kind of kid that will kind of blend with the wall, because oftentimes they've learned through experience that when you're living with this kind of parents, these parents may be prone to bouts of anger, aggression. So these kids have learned that the best way to survive is to keep a very low profile.
Very diplomatic.
That's right, very diplomatic. They will never say yes, they will never say no, just I don't want to talk about it, basically. And that's how they will go through life.
Three kinds of reactions.
Correct. Correct.
Okay. A while ago you were talking about temperaments.
Mm-hmm.
And all the while I thought it's just adults who has temperaments. Can you tell us about temperaments for
sure? Yes, when we talk about temperament, you know, most people typically wonder, you know, where does a child's personality come from?
Okay.
Right? And it turns out that when you talk about temperament, temperament is basically the biological component of a child's personality. So there's clearly a genetic component.
Oh, yeah.
And it has to do, when we talk about temperament, with, it's more about the how children do the way the things that they do rather than what they do. For example,
okay,
there are 9 temperament traits, so basically 9 dimensions of temperament.
Oh.
One of them is activity level, how active the child is. And activity level may range from very low, so the kid that, you know, is kind of quiet, that doesn't move much around,
you sit around.
That's right, sits around all day. As opposed to the kid on the opposite extreme of this kind of spectrum, this continuum, who is very active, running around, jumping, you know, driving the parents crazy.
Okay.
Kind of the hyperactive kid.
Uh-huh.
So that's one of the dimensions of temperament that we see is there from day one.
Uh-huh.
So the knowledge about temperament is important for parents because it helps parents to feel less guilty about what they may have done to the child, which is kind of the traditional, you know, thinking, gee, I may have done something wrong.
As the child will not come out as they want.
That's right. That's right. And oftentimes it turns out that the temperament, or because these 9 temperament traits, you know, activity level, regularity, bodily functions, for example, sleeping, eating, toileting, and the other 7, they will tend to cluster and create kind of a profile.
Mm-hmm.
That is different in different children.
Okay.
But it turns out that some of these temperament traits are also similar in one of the parents.
Oh, I see.
So
they got it from the parents.
That's right. So you may have an active boy whose father is also very active.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or the mother. Okay. Or a, you know, 5-year-old girl who is very cautious and shy and timid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. There's a temperament trait called approach versus withdrawal, which has to do with whether you are approaching new events, people, situation, or you're tending to kind of shy away from them.
Yes.
And so this, you know, 5-year-old girl who's kind of shy and timid may actually have, oftentimes, we see, a mother or a father who also has a similar temperament trait. And so that speaks, that suggests that there is clearly a genetic component to this.
Okay, so that's where the child starts to develop his or her own personality.
That's right. And you see from the get-go, already during the first, by the time the child is already, let's say, 4 months of age, you already start seeing some of this very unique. Yes. Yes. And in fact, any parent that, you know, has at least two children may tell you that, you know, nothing really has changed in our family, but this kid, this new girl or boy, is so different than the previous kid.
Yeah,
why? The reason is, in part, in large part, temperament. So the same way that, you know, the color of our hair or skin or, you know, the shape of our nose may change and be a combination of our parents' traits, temperament also works a little bit that way.
Nice. And what do this knowledge of temperament help us in our child rearing or dealing with our children?
Right. That's a very good question. The reason why we want to know about temperament is that you know, a lot of parents usually complain that, you know, I don't understand my child, and they would wish that they had a user's manual for their child, right? Okay, page 65, let's see, what am I supposed to do here? He's having a tantrum. Well, knowing about temperament is the next best thing to having a user's manual for your child.
Okay.
Because it really will tell you a lot about the style of behavior that your child uses when it comes to, for example, learning, or discipline, or interacting with other kids. And if you know about that, then you can customize your parenting style.
That's right.
According to the temperament style of your child. So that's why we never say that there is a good or bad temperament. It really has to do with what's called the goodness of fit.
Okay.
How good is the fit between the child's temperament and the parent's temperament? And once the parent knows about that, then they can be a lot more effective when it comes to, for example, disciplining your child. There's a big difference if you want to discipline a child who is, for example, easy, has an easy temperament, therefore can easily adjust to rules and limits, as opposed to the, you know, what's called a difficult temperament child, who is kind of feisty, doesn't like limits, has a hard time with adapting to change. That's a third trait of temperament. If you know that your child has a hard time adapting to change, and of course rules and limits are all about, you know, setting up changes, right? This activity is over, now it's time for dinner, and so on. Then, for example, you can anticipate that to the kid. All right, Eduardo, we're gonna have dinner in half an hour. If you know that your kid has a hard time adjusting.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, little Johnny who just takes like 2 seconds to adjust.
That's
sure, daddy. Right?
Yeah.
And if you don't know about that, then you're going to get in big trouble with Eduardo because he'll resist. No, I don't want to go. Right? You may have a similar temperament yourself because, again, of that genetic component. So the more aware you are of that, the more you can anticipate what's going to happen to the kid. And the more the child can think, well, okay, of course they're not really thinking it, but unconsciously they're realizing that, okay, I've been warned a few times, and if you follow through then as a parent, then you're telling the child, yep, daddy is not just talking, I know that in a few minutes something new will happen. And that little piece of knowledge, even though to us it may seem very small, to the kid makes a huge difference. Because it really helps them make the transition and therefore avoid tantrums. Which is the other big questions that, you know, I get all the time from parents.
You've been talking a lot about this. You have examples, concrete examples about this. Can you tell us about experiences with dealing with children?
Sure. For example, I remember some time ago I saw a family where it was a mother, and there was a 3.5-year-old little girl. And as it often is the case with mothers, at least, you know, back in the States, but I've seen also in many other cultures, same in Italy, and I would probably tend to assume even here in the Philippines, oftentimes it is hard for them to have an image of themselves as a caring mother and also as an effective mother when it comes to discipline.
Oh, I see.
Right, because they don't want to be perceived
as mercy.
That's right. They don't want to be perceived as kind of the bad guy or the bad person in the situation.
That's right.
And so what you do when you have a kid who is prone to tantrums, mm-hmm. you know, a kind of difficult child, very intense in their reaction, they don't like the rules. So there are times when I need to do some really kind of hands-on training with the mother and the child. So you may sit down, for example, in a situation like this, you know, on this carpet, set up a situation where the child is supposed to play for a few minutes, and then we're going to have something else happening. Okay, now it's time to go back to the table and we're going to do some drawing. Okay, a child with a difficult temperament will react strongly. No, I don't want to do that, blah, 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 blah. So I can actually coach the parent and teach them, for example, to anticipate to the child. So that literally, I may actually say, all right, miss, blah, 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 tell the child that in 10 minutes, it'll be time to go to the table and start to do some drawing or, you know, some other activity. Mm-hmm. It's hard for parents oftentimes, first, because they don't like to be in the role of the person that, you know, has to learn things.
Yeah, that's right.
But after a while, they get comfortable with that, and when they see that it works, then they say, oh, okay, maybe I can do that at home. And so first we do it here, in a more kind of controlled environment, and then they start doing it at home.
Okay.
It's also the same when it comes to how to react to a tantrum, or actually how to prevent a tantrum. Uh-huh. And one of the best ways is usually to be able to follow through with your rules and limits. Because with a difficult child, the difficult child will push the envelope, right? Will push the limit.
Yeah.
Okay. So the mother may test the limit. So the mother may say, "Okay, John, in 10 minutes, we gotta go. We have to do something else." Mm-hmm. Of course, 10 minutes go by. Time comes up that, you know, we need to do something else. And of course, the kid will push the envelope, will try to resist, and they can be very creative, right?
Okay.
Sometimes they may get really aggressive, or they may throw themselves on the floor. I've had kids that will start vomiting, anything, right? Not to do that.
Okay.
Anything that will prevent them from doing what they don't want to do. And a lot of mothers, but fathers too sometimes, will basically after a while will just give up, say, all right, do what you want. Right? In doing that, of course, they're doing exactly the opposite of what they should be doing, which is to follow through. And stick to the limits. Mm-hmm. And the reason why it's hard for them is that they don't want to be perceived, particularly in the eyes of someone else, as the disciplinarian.
Okay.
But when you tell them, you know, you can be a good mother and yet a firm mother.
Firm.
You know, so that you can be firm with your limits, rules, and boundaries. Then after a while of practicing this, it really starts changing their own perception, and they realize that I can be nurturing with my kid, but I can also be firm so that I'm the boss, I'm the one in charge and not the kid. And when they do that, like magic and almost like clockwork, the child's own behavior will change dramatically. So that instead of spending 10 times saying, all right, Johnny, we gotta go, they'll just say once and the kid does it.
That's it. Yeah, talking about temperament, I remember my experience with my own kids.
Mm-hmm.
I was telling you that.
Oh yes.
There's two of them. One you can just call,
right,
in an instant.
That's right.
The other one will take time before he answers your call.
That's right.
But I noticed also that, like what you said, like in 10 minutes time we're going to have dinner.
Right.
By the time he will already be starting to arrange his toys or pack up his toys.
Right.
And afterwards, when it's packed up, he gets up and goes to the dinner table.
Right.
Or in 10 minutes time, please turn off the TV.
Right.
So you have to
anticipate.
Customize.
Yes.
When this kid is the one watching TV,
that's right.
Please turn off the TV, come down here.
Right. And he'll do it
then. But then my other kid will say, please turn off the TV, don't expect
us. Oh, it wouldn't work.
But, well, the technique there is, in 10 minutes time,
right,
I want you to come down here, please turn off the TV after 10 minutes.
Right, allowing the child to anticipate.
Yes.
And a lot of it has to do also with brain development, because for us, you know, our memory skills, our ability to anticipate and kind of picture in our mind's eye what's going to happen is very well developed, right? Because we've used it thousands, millions of times during our, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. But for children, they really have to learn that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in addition to temperament, you also have to consider kind of the age of the child,
okay,
and you know, their kind of mental skills. Mm-hmm. So by anticipating, you're actually helping the child to start creating a mental picture of how things usually work out, right? Typically, in every family, there are routines.
Yeah,
things
right.
are done in a certain way. You know, for example, the classic would be, you know, bedtime. Okay, child has had dinner. Now it's time to brush your teeth. Maybe we're going to read a story. Uh-huh. We're going to put your PJ on, and then finally we're going to go to bed, right? And children do need to know about these routines because it's really what helps them figure out how the world works, how uh-huh. relationships work. And the more they are able to anticipate what's going to happen, the less anxiety they experience when it comes to moving from one activity to another.
Boy.
Because it's anxiety oftentimes will trigger these fears and these strong reactions.
So they have to learn how to go through a routine.
That's right. That's right.
So that new activities will not be fearful
right.
for them.
That's right. That's right. Of course, then for the easy child, you know, new activities are going to be relatively easy to adapt to, but a lot of kids are not that easy. So, you know, I'd rather be, you know, more kind of conservative.
Maybe,
so
maybe
to
majority
say,
of the
that's
kids.
That's right. Well, quite a few. Quite a few.
Okay.
So, you know, helping kids anticipate never hurts.
Uh-huh.
You know.
What about, Nick, what about giving kids the power to decide? I mean, how...
Right.
How does this go about with their temperament?
Right. My kind of rule of thumb is that, you know, little choices for little kids, bigger choices for bigger kids.
Okay, examples.
For example, why is it that we want to give children choices, right? And why is it that we want to allow them to make decisions,
okay.
right? Well, it may vary from culture to culture, but I think that most of us would probably agree that eventually these kids will grow up, and we want to make sure as parents that they will be able to make the best choices.
That's right.
The best decisions. Mm-hmm. But the process of deciding things is, as with many other things, a learned skill.
Mm-hmm. It's
right?
a learned
Children
skill.
Need to practice that skill. So the classic example is with, let's say, a 2.5, 3-year-old, to help them decide. You know, it's like a muscle, right? Our brain works like a muscle. You have to start with little things first.
Yeah.
So the classic choice would be between, I don't know, two different kind of clothes or two different colors.
Mm.
Oh, it's chilly outside today, Samantha. Do you want to wear the green sweater or the blue one?
Okay.
Very simple choice, right?
Right.
To us. But for them, it's a, you know, it takes a lot of mental power. And they'll be able
which
to tell
one
them, yeah, which one should I wear, the green or the blue, and then they'll pick one.
Okay.
Now, realize that, of course, they're choosing, but we're setting the context. So it's a choice among two things that we already have established.
Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of helping them bring down these choices from a whole variety of colors to just two. Because otherwise they would feel overwhelmed, and you would spend, you know, 10 hours just deciding what to wear. All right. So again, for little kids, little choices.
Okay.
For the bigger kids, you know, a bigger choice, which could be, you know, okay, do you want to come back, you know, you're dealing with a teenager or something, you know, of that age. Okay, I'm going to give you two choices for, you know, in terms of the time that you're supposed to come back. You can come back at, you know, 8 or 8:30, which one do you want? Okay, or 8 or 9 o'clock. Okay. So you as the parent establish what the two choices are, and then they are allowed to choose.
At the same time, you've established a curfew.
That's right.
Yet, it's their decision.
That's right.
To choose which one.
That's right.
Are they going back?
That's right. Of course, if you're giving those kind of choices, you have to be prepared for when the child will not follow through with their own decision.
Okay, so what
you have to have a consequence.
Uh-huh.
So you have to make the child aware of the consequence. And let me remind you, John, that if it turns out that you chose not to come back at the time that you told me you would, this is what's going to happen. For example, you will not be allowed to go out for the next 3 days.
Mm,
is that what you want?
Yeah.
Right?
That's right.
And if that happens, you have to follow through. If you don't follow through, you're telling the kid, well, I was just talking. And of course, what do you think is going to happen next time? He's going to do it again, right?
That's the limit.
That's right. And it's hard for us to stick to our own rules and limits because, gee, do I really have to get up from the sofa, right? I was so comfortable reading the paper. But if you don't, who's going to be in charge?
But I think that's a very brilliant way of establishing curfews, especially for teenagers.
Right.
Because if you just tell your kid, be back here by 9 o'clock.
Right.
That seems to be so authoritative.
Right.
But if you tell your kid, what time do you want to be back? 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock?
Right.
Definitely, right. He or she is going to just 9 o'clock.
Of course.
But yet, that's already his choice.
Right. That's right.
So, you gave him the power, but at the same time, you have accomplished what you want accomplished.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, you know, it takes a lot of, you know, thinking power on our parts, mm-hmm. as, you know, people working with children or parents. But once you do that, it really simplifies your life a lot. Because again, ultimately, you're allowing your child to develop those very same skills, decision power, and so on, that they will use all the time later on in their, you know, grown-up lives.
Yes, and decision powers are very important because not all the time we have our kids with us.
That's right. That's right.
They go to school, right. And they grow up. They go to boarding school.
That's right.
And if we have empowered them with good decision
right.
skills, then we ourselves, parents, will be very confident that
right.
our child is okay or somewhere out there.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. And research shows very clearly that, you know, the best kind of developmental outcome is really typically with children that have had parents that, instead of being, you know, authoritarian and say, okay, you got to do this, you got to do that, and there's no choices, the best outcome comes from, you know, children of parents that have given them choices.
Yeah.
Within their own limits.
Yes,
so you as the parents, you always have to set the limits, the boundaries, mm-hmm. and then within those boundaries, if it's okay with you, and that's why you have to think it through first,
yeah, that's right.
then the child can choose.
Uh-huh. Welcome back to Usapang Medical. A while ago, Nick and I have been talking about child temperaments, autism, behavior problems, and now there's a very popular topic about children, and that it's ADHD. Let's ask Nick, what are your thoughts about this? Have you encountered problems like this already in your practice?
Yes, several patients, the parents of children came in the past few months either asking me about ADHD or with a child that they think may have ADHD. Mm-hmm. Of course, it's a huge topic. We just don't have time to go into
in the papers.
This. Yes, yes, it definitely has become the buzzword, so to say, as I call it, among parents and teachers for the past, I would say, at least 2 decades, certainly in the States, and I'm realizing more and more even here in the Philippines.
Okay.
So as such, that deserves a lot of attention, of course. Too often, I think that, as you know, with all buzzwords, the term ADHD is used very quickly to describe behaviors in very different children that may not actually be symptomatic of true ADHD.
Oh,
in other words, what I mean by that is that oftentimes I hear parents say, yeah, my child is very active, I got a 3.5-year-old, mm-hmm. he's very active, runs around all the time, I'm really worried that he may have ADHD.
Okay.
And then it turns out that they just spoken with a teacher who has just been to a training on ADHD.
Okay.
And so what happens, to draw a parallel, is, you know, it's like when you want to buy a new car, right? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden you start noticing a lot of cars around there that look exactly like the car that you want to buy, right? What that means is that your expectation to see something will make you start seeing things.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And what that means is that oftentimes I hear that, you know, teachers may go through some trainings, let's say for a couple of days, and then all of a sudden they see a lot of the kids that they have, and they think, God, you know, I think this kid has ADHD.
ADHD.
Then they're gonna tell the parent, uh-huh. you know, I think your little, you know, 4.5-year-old may have ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what is the parent gonna think? Oh my God, right? And so we really have to be cautious when we use these terms and people that are not trained in diagnosing children with ADHD will then tell parents. Because that's typically oftentimes how you really get started.
Before we go on, Nick, ADHD stands for?
ADHD stands for Attention Deficit Hyperactivity Disorder.
Disorder.
It used to be called ADD.
Okay.
Now it's ADHD. The reason it's called ADHD is that some children will exhibit only the attention deficit
okay.
part of the disorder,
uh-huh.
but not the hyperactivity.
Boy.
Other children will exhibit only the hyperactivity, so being very, you know, hyper, very active, but not the inability to pay attention. And a lot of kids will exhibit both, the inability to pay attention and this very high activity level.
Very, very hyperactive.
So just because you are ADHD, it doesn't mean that you're going to be identical to all the other kids that have been diagnosed with ADHD. In fact, there's basically other subcategories.
So you were saying a while ago that they can show the symptoms of ADHD, but not necessarily they are ADHD.
Correct. Correct.
How's that? How's that?
Right. The classic example would be, I've seen a lot of kids in the past who may come from families where there's a lot of family disagreement, arguing, violence, or for example, the parents are in the process of splitting up or divorcing or separating.
Okay.
That creates a lot of tension in the family.
Uh-huh.
And that oftentimes would then lead the child to, for example, being, particularly if they already have a temperament who is already on the active side,
okay,
it will really kind of escalate that and will make the child being, you know, overly active, what we would call hyperactive.
Uh-huh.
You would have the same child probably being so preoccupied mentally with things, with the things that are going in the house, that literally they do not have the ability to pay attention to things when it comes to, for example, learning.
Learning in school, right.
So the teacher may say, you know, I don't understand what's going on with Johnny or Eduardo. You know, we've been working on this concept for like, you know, 10 days. I keep repeating things and just nothing seems to be sticking. You know, he just doesn't get it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he cannot get it because his mind is completely somewhere else.
Yeah.
You know, the mind of this child is onto some things that are a lot more important, unfortunately, for him at that specific moment in his life than, you know, some simple learning. But if you were to look at the behaviors not knowing about the background, then it would be very easy to see, to perceive this child as a child with ADHD.
Uh-huh.
You know, low attention, a lot of hyperactivity, maybe bumping into things. But if you know about the background, then you will probably not be prone to say, yeah, this is a kid with ADHD. And when a child like this comes to my office to be assessed, one of the things that I do, first of all, is to spend a long time with the parent, sometimes a couple of hours, knowing about the background of this child and his family.
Oh, I see.
Because if I don't know about that, I cannot be effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I may actually run the risk of diagnosing this child with ADHD and perhaps later on recommending medication, when in reality the child does not have that.
Does not need that.
Right. And we have to be careful, because the moment you start diagnosing children with a certain, you know, heavy duty diagnosis like ADHD, that diagnosis will stick for a long time to the kid.
Okay.
Throughout the, you know, school years.
Uh-huh.
It may create stigma, you know, feelings of being different in the child. So one has to be really cautious, particularly if then medication is recommended, because we're playing with the child's brain.
That's right. So. And for, okay, but when the child really has true ADHD,
yes,
medication should say.
Medication is often recommended. For example, Ritalin, which is the classic. Paradoxically, it's actually a stimulant, which you would think that's the last thing you want to give to a kid who's already very hyper. But it turns out that even though we still don't know, science really doesn't know why or what are the exact mechanisms that Ritalin works, through which Ritalin works, affecting the brain, we know that it works really well.
Okay.
Now, as a child psychologist, I am not the person that will prescribe the medication. That is not my role. Typically, that's the child psychiatrist.
Okay.
That's a very different. But as a child psychologist, I may do the assessment, and then I may recommend the child to be seen by a psychiatrist who then will recommend and actually prescribe the medication.
Your part is the therapy part.
That's right. The therapy and the assessment.
The assessment.
Then with that piece, the family can go to the child psychiatrist and say, okay, there's been an assessment, the child seems to be in need of medication. And the psychiatrist, if he or she agrees with that, typically they do, because that assessment comes with a lot of results and supporting evidence. Then they'll prescribe the medication, and they will monitor the effect of the medication over the span of a few months in the life of the child. Typically, it starts with a very small dosage for a week or so, and then they see, that's right, So it's increased incrementally in very small doses to see what is the minimum dosage that it can be given to the child that will A, lead to a positive change in the child's behavior, and B, it will lead to very few side effects.
That's right.
Because unfortunately, all medications have some side effects. So that's why we really have to be very careful.
Okay. So we were talking a while ago that the diagnosis can stick with the child for quite some time. Does this mean that there is also adult ADHD?
Right. And before we go to that, this is very important because I want to make sure that our listeners and viewers understand that in the case of a child or an adult with ADHD, medication by itself is not the final answer.
Yeah.
The best combination, research and clinical work shows very clearly, is always with medication and therapy. Okay, so let's not forget that therapy is wonderful, but oftentimes needs medication. And by the same token, medication is wonderful, but most of the times it also needs therapy.
There has to be a multidisciplinary approach again.
That's right.
That's very good.
Now, going back to the adults, let's not forget, of course, that the kids that we're seeing today are going to be the adults of tomorrow. And the adults that we're seeing right now, not me, but some of my other colleagues that work with adults, used to be children. And so yes, we do have adults that suffer from ADHD.
Okay.
By the time a person is an adult, it's a lot easier in a certain way to diagnose ADHD, because when you're dealing conversely with a child who is, for example, like a three-year-old, a lot of three-year-olds will probably be very active. They will not pay much attention. So it's a lot trickier to diagnose ADHD at a very young age, because that may be kind of, you know, confused with a behavior that is overall common for a lot of the little ones. But by the time you're, you know, like a teenager, and you know, even more the case, you know, 20, 30 year old, your behaviors are such that they're certainly not due to, you know, immaturity in terms of, you know, development, but more by a tendency of your brain to, for example, not pay attention or being all kind of revved up and too active. So in that case, it's a lot easier for the clinician to assess and diagnose the presence of ADHD.
I was thinking, Nick, they're signaling us for the time. And
oh, okay. Time to wrap it up, I guess.
So sure. It's interesting. I was thinking, like, because we have experiences, like we have friends who jump from one course to another, they seem not to finish college. There seem to be an ingredient of, like, attention deficit also in that aspect, in a broader sense.
Sometimes that's the case. Sometimes that is the case. You know, these adults may have a hard time focusing on a subject for you know, a long period of time. It really depends. There may be a lot of different reasons. When we're talking about ADHD, we talk about a person who has a hard time focusing their attention within a very limited amount of time. So we're talking about, you know, a few minutes.
Okay.
Rather than, okay, I'm going to be studying this subject for, you know, a few months and then move on to another one. So what we're seeing in graduate school, or, you know, people that go through that training, jumping from one, you know, field to another, may not necessarily be due to ADHD, although sometimes it might, but maybe to, you know, realizing that that's not their cup of tea, so they want to change. And let's not forget, of course, that, you know, graduate school and those, you know, intense trainings require a lot of, you know, perseverance. And I would be more inclined to think that maybe these are adults who may have a temperament, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, and one of the temperament traits is persistence. So they may be adults low in persistence.
Okay. Maybe for 5 minutes you can tell us about like in adults, we have executive checkups.
Okay.
In pediatrics, we have well baby checkups.
Oh, yes, yes.
In children, do you also have, like in psychology, you have also well baby or well child, well adolescent checkups?
What I usually do, I am available to collaborate and work with pediatricians. Mm-hmm. I was talking actually with one of them just yesterday, and the idea is that pediatricians go through a lot of children that they see for, you know, this kind of well baby checkups.
Yeah.
So they see a lot of kids, and from time to time, because they've seen so many kids that are so good at spotting out the child that just doesn't fit the expectation.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So they may see from time to time some kids that they're a little bit off, whether it's language or motor skills or cognitive skills. Mm-hmm. And so they're in the best position to do a referral to me and say, you know, Dr. Nick, I have the feeling there's something wrong with this kid. I don't know what it is, but could you do a developmental assessment?
Oh,
and that's when I kick in.
Okay.
Other times they may ask me to, for example, talk with the parent in a way that I can do what's called anticipatory guidance, which is, again, a fancy word for saying, well, how do I handle this kid?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the classic case would be, you know, a new mom or a new dad.
Yeah.
They have no experience with children. They may have read about it, but lo and behold, the child that they get is very different from what the textbook says, right?
Okay.
And how do they cope with that?
That's right.
So I can actually, you know, work with them, letting them know some of the things that they need to expect.
Uh-huh.
For example, that at a certain age, let's say age 12 months, because the child is starting to walk, and they're using a lot of, so to say, mental and physical energy to learn how to walk, they need to expect that in other areas of development, for example, you know, sleeping, eating, there will probably be some problems.
Okay.
It's as if the brain can't do it all at once. Something has to give.
Uh-huh, yeah.
So as the brain is so busy developing one set of skills,
uh-huh,
the other ones that have been developed before may take a toll temporarily.
Temporary.
Now, if the parent sees that, not knowing that those skills will then come back,
yeah,
they will probably panic.
Uh-huh.
Right? They say, oh my God, what's going on? The kid that used to be so regular in sleeping or eating, now all of a sudden cannot eat anymore or can sleep anymore. What's going on? But if they know, because you've been anticipating with them,
yeah,
that
right,
that will happen, then they can kind of relax and say, oh, okay, all right, I know it will be different.
Yeah.
I know that my long nights, waking up at 4:30 in the morning every night, will pass.
That's very good. At least we know now for that Nick is handling not only behavior problems,
right,
but also well children.
Correct.
And
correct,
especially would-be parents or
yes,
brand new parents.
Right, right.
Anticipatory guidance, you
yes,
say. That's very, because it's very scary to be a parent.
Oh, absolutely.
Much more if you really love your children and you really want them to grow.
Right.
Best adults,
right, particularly for parents, you know, I've seen, you know, many parents that may have a child who was born prematurely.
Mm-hmm.
So dealing with a child that is a preemie baby is very different,
yeah,
because their nervous system is still a little bit immature.
Uh-huh.
It's very different than dealing with a full-term baby.
If you have 100% attention to a full-term baby, maybe for a preemie you need to have 150%
that's
attention.
Right. That's right, because these children oftentimes are very sensitive.
Uh-huh.
They may have a temperament who's kind of a little bit on the difficult side because their nervous system is too sensitive. And so by educating the parent about that, then the parent can be more effective in their, you know, parenting style and care of the child.
Okay, Nick, they're signaling us for time.
Okay.
Where can they consult you if they need to have, if they have more questions, they want to bring their children, or they want to have some tips with you regarding anticipatory guidance, where can they find you?
Yes, they can find me at the Child Psychology Clinic,
mm-hmm,
here at the Bacolod Adventist Medical Center.
Okay.
My clinic hours are Mondays through Thursdays,
okay,
from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. They can call the number that is shown right now,
yeah,
on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
Either myself or my secretary will answer any call.
Mm-hmm.
We can set up an appointment.
Okay.
And then we can just take it from there.
That's room 137.
Yes, room 137, Child Psychology Clinic at the Bacolod Adventist Medical Center.
Yeah, I've seen there are some toys here in your clinic. Can you tell us what are these?
I mean, yes, yes.
This room is for what?
Yeah, this room, I have two rooms. One room is for assessments, so it's typically a room that doesn't really have that many toys because we don't want to distract the child as they're being assessed. This other room, the room that we're currently in, with some of the toys right here in the background, this is called the play room, where we typically do play therapy.
Oh, I see.
So we're not just playing around. It's hard work on my part and particularly on the part of the child. Uh-huh. Because play is the natural way that children will tell us, psychologists and adults in general, what is going on in their minds. Because if we ask a child that, for example, has some behavioral traumas, well, Eduardo, why is it that you're doing what you're doing? Almost 100% of the times the child will say, I don't know. Or I don't want to talk about it.
Okay.
But if we allow them to play out whatever is going on up here, with the toys that we have, most of the times they will show us what it is that is creating the problem that they may have, you know, at school or at home, that will then elicit these behavioral problems. They will tell us that through play. So that's why play is very important, for particularly for the little ones, for the young kids. So in my office, in the play therapy room, I have different kinds of toys that have been chosen very carefully. Nothing that you see here was selected at random.
You have a dollhouse over here?
Yes, there's a dollhouse here. Mm-hmm. That's typically used for children that may experience or live in a family environment where there may be a lot of tension, disagreements, anger, sometimes even violence or verbal abuse. And because it's so hard for them to tell us what's going on, if we were to ask them, they would say, oh no, my parents are fine, nothing's going on with them. But if we allow them to play with a toy like this, with the playhouse and the human figures, many of them will play out, literally, with these toys, the conflicts that they see on a daily basis in their house. And that's going to give me an insight of what's going on.
Okay. That's why there's the mother and father over there.
That's right. That's right.
Okay.
So, you know, I could show you if you want me to, or we can do it some other time.
Some other time, maybe.
But the idea, again, is they will use the toys in a way that they will create certain kind of small world, so to say.
Like reenact it.
Correct.
Through play.
That's right. Oftentimes, you know, we also have, I also have animals here. The animals are very useful in therapy because children can relate to animals wonderfully, right?
Yeah.
You know, if I ask the child, you know, why is it that they're being so aggressive at school? Okay. They would probably say, I don't know, I don't want to talk about it. Is it time? I want to go home. Anything not to talk about it. But if I use, for example, either an animal or a puppet, and you know, these figures are animal-like. This could be the lion or the dog, one of these. And if the question comes from the dog or the lion rather than me, and if the child is allowed to use one of these other puppets, then it's not them, but it's the puppet who may tell me, yeah, I'm mad when dad comes home all drunk and then blah, 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 blah. Oh. So it's not them
talking,
but it's the animal. Wow. And they're a lot more comfortable. As long as it's the animal talking, it's not them, right? That's what they're thinking.
Yeah, that's right.
So in a certain way, they're allowed to tell us what they're thinking, but through something else. And that's crucial because it makes the child, at the end of the day, feel a lot safer, because it's all about feeling safe in here. Mm-hmm. If the child feels safe, then they can kind of open up. Like us, right?
Yeah.
It's the same for adults. When you feel safe, you're probably going to be willing to talk.
Yeah, okay.
And animals help us do that, because it's kind of a natural connection. All children love animals, right?
Last message, Nick, for our televiewers?
Well, I would say, I'm available to the Bacolod community and the community of the entire Negros Island and the Visayas in general to see children. My expertise is 0 to 10, but sometimes I also see older children for any kind of psychological or developmental problems.
Okay.
Or as we were saying earlier, well, baby checkups. Teachers and other
You also give lectures to schools?
I also give lectures.
Seminars?
Yes, seminars and trainings on different topics in schools, also hospitals.
Yeah.
Both for parents, teachers, practitioners, students, pediatricians. So that's another way that I'm trying to reach out to the community, make them aware of my services, and really make a better future for the kids in this area.
That's true. Thank you very much, Nick. There you have, we have a child psychologist here in Bacolod City who is very much willing to help us train our children and deal with behavioral problems if we have with our children. Thank you for spending time with us. I hope this will not be the last. We will have another episode maybe sometime this year.
Yes, I'm always here.
Okay, thank you for watching Usapang Medical. God bless.